Good morning. I'm going to be reading a prayer for LGBT people in Indiana. It's a portion of a presentation by Reverend Meg Riley. This prayer is for you. May you know you are a child of God, beautiful and beloved, just as you are. May you know that your worth and dignity can never be voted away. May you know your people, living, dead, not yet born, and hold them to you. May you know that straight allies who hold you dear are aching with you. May you feel the support of people you will never meet, of all orientations and genders. May you refuse to be a witness in the trial against yourself and your people. May you know that your love is the precious gift you have been given. May you feel compassion for all people, all around the world, who have been told they did not matter. And may that compassion sustain you. May you live in love. May you live in love. Now, if you would remain seated, we have our meditation hymn, number 295 in the hymnal, Sing Out Praises for the Journey. This is my presentation, my personal journey through the history of LGBTA liberation. I'll introduce myself again. I am Brian Heike. I am president of Gay Grassroots of Northwest Florida, Emerald Coast Equality, and vice president of the Santa Rosa County Democratic Women's Club. We hear a lot about nature versus nurture. I often hear the phrase, love the sinner, hate the sin. I was born this way. I am no more a sinner than any straight man, and less of a sinner than most. I knew that there was something different about me when I was very young. My dad told me that he didn't want me to grow up to be a sissy. That worried me. I grew up in northern New Jersey, 15 miles outside of Manhattan. My hometown was an idyllic town to grow up in, particularly if you were white, straight, and male. I was a square peg in a round hole and always felt out of place, particularly once I hit puberty. I started having feelings that I didn't understand at first. Then there were physiological manifestations of that attraction. I had no control over that. This was 1964, the year the Beatles invaded our consciousness and took over the world. There were no gay role models. There was no positive message that I could hold on to. I felt that I was all alone in the world. I was embarrassed and afraid, So I went into hiding deep inside myself. I hid my feelings from the world. I felt that my secret would be my destruction, so I controlled everything completely. God forbid that someone would find me out. I was always true to myself. I could not pretend to be interested in girls. I didn't date. I didn't attend functions where you were expected to bring a date. I didn't go to my proms. I had a few good friends whom I played tennis with all summer. During the school year, however, I buried my head in my books. I was an outstanding student, graduating fourth in my class, but I was socially inept and naive. Particularly back then, but often still today, LGBT people don't have the opportunity to experience the normal evolution of dating and interacting with possible romantic and sexual partners in the typical progression of trial and error that our straight counterparts do. There is no social framework for us, no role models, no support network, and no way of organically learning and growing so that we could eventually have healthy relationships. At least that's the way it was for me. I had the additional complication of having my mother work at the college that I went to. Often people explore at college. You would think as an art major, I would have had the opportunity to blossom into the person I always really was and should have become. The idea of my mother finding out kept me from exploring my feelings. Once I graduated, it was more and more apparent to me that I was gay. I ended a platonic relationship with the girl I was dating as a last-ditch attempt to see if I could be someone that I wasn't. It was 1974, 5 years after Stonewall. I started reading The Village Voice, the only source of information that I knew about being gay. I finally found out about the Gay Activists Alliance of Northern New Jersey. I decided that was where I needed to come out. I arrived at the location, nervous as hell, was greeted at the door by an amazing transgender woman, and introduced to one of the male officers who decided to plant a lingering kiss on my mouth. That was the moment I knew for sure who I was. I was gay, and as it turns out, I was a gay rights activist. My first Pride March was in New York City in Greenwich Village in 1974. That's a long time ago. I started going out to gay bars in New Jersey. They were all mafia-owned, and behavior was strictly monitored, and strict rules were enforced. We may have had a Tom Jones lighted dance floor with colorful lighting underneath frosted floor tiles that were programmed to pulse, change colors, and change patterns to the beat of the music, but we were not allowed to touch each other while dancing. The bar could have been raided and fined. They paid for police protection, but the police would do occasional sweeps through the bar. By the end of that summer, I met my first partner at a local bar in New Jersey. I was a Sears portrait photographer by day and a disco dancer at night. I actually met Dennis on the dance floor. We were both inexperienced and totally naive. We thought we were forever, but we were a dating learning experience, and the experiment failed. We have remained good friends all these years. So I was single again. I started going to discos and bars in Manhattan, often dancing until 4 a.m. Some gay men started adopting the Christopher Street clone look, which was hyper-masculinized. Flannel shirts, work boots, denim jeans or shorts, leather bomber jackets, leather motorcycle jackets. It was the West Village look. We were embracing a side of us that was always denied to gay men before this. We had been stereotyped as effeminate. There is a wide variation of gender expression in the gay community. We can present as masculine and hard, or feminine and soft, and everywhere between those two extremes. There is no one way to be gay. I, however, decided to be a clone. I doubt it carried it off very well, but I was embracing my community and a new self-image. In the meantime, I entered the corporate world and needed to hide in the closet to keep my job and to move up the corporate ladder. Coming out on the job was a perilous decision for people. It still is, particularly here. You risk your job and an interruption in your health benefits. You may even risk your safety. Life moved on. My first apartment was in Manhattan. I moved there in 1980. There were rumors of a deadly condition in our community, the first indication of what was to come. In May of 1982, the New York Times had the first article describing a frightening health development. Gay men were developing a type of cancer called Kaposi's sarcoma, which up until then had only been seen in elderly men. This was one of the opportunistic infections that were part of a broader immune disorder that the researchers called GRID, an acronym for gay-related immunodeficiency. No one knew what the risk factors were. We lived in fear. Eventually, it was determined to be infectious and a virus, spread through blood and other body fluids. It was a frightening time to be gay and single in Manhattan. In 1982, 335 people were suffering from symptoms and 136 had died. It was the tip of the iceberg. By 1987, close to 50,000 Americans had died of AIDS. I found out that I was HIV positive in 1986. By the early 90s, I met the criteria for being diagnosed with AIDS. I was now a statistic. There was no effective treatment. Between 1988 and 1992, there were 181,000 deaths. The number increased over the next decade, and even though deaths declined, the rate of infection increased dramatically. You can imagine the fear. First, I was afraid that I might be affected. Then I started losing friends to AIDS. I went to support groups, and it was exactly as it was portrayed in the play in the film of Rent. One after another, people died and disappeared from these support groups. Those of us who have lived with the virus this long have faced innumerable challenges, very often life-threatening ones. We faced being thought of as pariahs. We faced discrimination. We dealt with hatred. We dealt with people being afraid of us. We dealt with what seemed like an immutable eventuality, that we would die soon and way too young. We watched friends and loved ones fight, suffer, and then succumb to a horrible death. It was an extremely painful way to die. It was also emotionally excruciating to watch someone whom you loved and cared for face such pain. We lived through so much loss. When I was at my sickest in the mid-90s and had to stop working to go on disability, I became an HIV activist. I was given 18 months to live, and I wanted to make the rest of my time here on this planet mean something. I volunteered with a local AIDS service organization, heading up a spirituality and psychotherapy committee, and leading a support group for family and friends of people living with HIV. I joined the local Ryan White Planning Councils in New Jersey and in Philadelphia, and lobbied Congress for increased AIDS funding. Just when it looked like I was staring death in the face, the protease inhibitors in the cocktail came out, sparing my life and the lives of many others. We are still here. Most of us are bruised and battle-scarred. Many of us suffer from PTSD from our experiences. We are the lucky ones. We are the ones who survived. Some of us are still suffering from both HIV-related health issues or persistent side effects from our medications. The medications were harsh. I must have taken 11 or 12 different HIV medications over the years. We long-term survivors are lucky to be here. I view it both as a blessing and a responsibility. I vowed to make my life count, to dedicate my life to helping LGBT people be treated as equal citizens, and for those of us who are HIV positive to be treated with compassion, understanding, and respect. You may wonder how I lived through all of this and emerged from it scarred, but mostly optimistic about life and my place in the world. I felt that I had not really lived life yet at 34 years of age in 1986. I was only 34 when I found out I was positive. When I found out I was positive, I knew I had a decision to make. Either give up and give in and die, which many people did, or fight for my life. I wanted my life to mean something and to accomplish something with it, and I had to survive in order to do this. I made a pact with God. I know you're not supposed to make pacts with God, but I made a pact with God. I prayed. I promised that I would do everything in my power to survive if he would help me make it through to the next medical breakthrough, and then the next, and the next. I knew that it was pointless to be asked to be cured. There was no cure on the horizon. There still is no cure, but you can live and thrive with HIV now. I don't know if God heard my prayers, but I am still living and breathing. I am one of the lucky ones. I have lived in Navarre for 14 years. HIV has not disappeared, but is manageable in this country, at least. Elsewhere, it's still raging. I had burned out as an HIV activist. I had so many losses. But I focused my energies on LGBT activism again, founding Gay Grassroots of Northwest Florida with my partner Doug and a few other dedicated people 10 years ago. June 15th will be our 10th festival in the park. We offer a wide variety of events over the course of the week, and a schedule of events in our program are available after the service. So much was accomplished over the course of the past few years. In September of 2011, Don't Ask, Don't Tell ended, and LGBT people were free to live openly in the military. Gay Grassroots spoke out loudly about this issue and also fought hard for marriage equality. For many years, we had a pastor perform union ceremonies at our Pensacola Pride Festival in the park. Those ceremonies were not legally binding, but were incredibly affirming to gay couples wanting to have some kind of formal recognition of their relationships. Those union ceremonies were joyful events. On January 6th of 2015, marriage equality came to Florida. We witnessed the pastor of Holy Cross MCC perform weddings all day long on the first day that it was legal. It was a dream come true for our community. It felt as if we finally gained parity with everyone else. We had reached our goal. We felt invincible. We felt that we had finally grabbed the brass ring. Over the last 2 years, I have had a growing fear that what we had worked so hard for and finally realized is now again at risk. Violence against vulnerable groups has significantly increased since then, particularly against LGBT people. Rhetoric has become heated. Religious freedom laws now threaten to make it legal to discriminate against LGBT people. We are at a crossroads. This country will either embrace us as full citizens with equal rights, or take us backward 50 years to a time when we had to live in the shadows. We cannot let that happen. We refuse to go back in the closet. We vow to continue our fight to stand proudly as equals with everyone else in America. That day will come. It cannot come soon enough for me. Thank you. I'm going to read you quotes from an interview with James Baldwin. He was a black gay man and an author that received lots of accolades. He was a seminal writer in the LGBT movement. It's very frightening, but the so-called straight person is no safer than I am, really. Loving anybody and being loved by anybody is a tremendous danger, a tremendous responsibility. Loving of children, raising of children, the terrors homosexuals go through in this society would not be so great if society itself did not go through so many terrors which it doesn't want to admit. The discovery of one's sexual orientation doesn't have to be a trauma. It's a trauma because it's such a traumatized society. There is nothing in me that is not in everybody else, and nothing in everybody else that is not in me. We're trapped in language, of course, but homosexual is not a noun, at least not in my book. Perhaps a verb. You see, I can only talk about my own life. I loved a few people and they loved me. It had nothing to do with these labels. Of course, the world has all kinds of words for us, but that's the world's problem. Best advice I ever got was an old friend of mine, a black friend, who said, "You have to go the way your blood beats. If you don't live the only life you have, you won't live some other life. You won't live any life at all." That's the only advice you can give anybody. And it's not advice, it's an observation. I'd like people to stand for our closing hymn, number 38 in the hymnals, "These Things Shall Be." Did I say that wrong?
138.
That's what I thought I said.
Now for our benediction. If we agree in love, there is no disagreement that can do us any injury. But if we do not, no other agreement can do us any good. Let us endeavor to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bonds of peace. Go in peace.